Have you tried changing your health year on year, resolving that this year things are going to be different, but nothing seems to change? Oftentimes, when things are not changing, we are following many wellness myths and not looking at the full picture, including our nutrition, recovery, stress management, leaving out mind-body connection. I want to introduce you to Wellness Redefined, a new podcast from Rufilion Media that's here to dispel all your myths about wellness and fitness while sharing stories of how we've redefined what it means to be healthy. On each episode, we'll be talking to experts from all walks of life who will share their own unique wellness journey and offer their perspective. I am your host, Tamika Rochester, founder and CEO of Harlem Cycle, a premier wellness space in New York City with a focus on indoor cycling. I've been an advocate for wellness since as early as I can remember. So if this sounds like something that could help change your life, go ahead and pause the show you're listening to and subscribe to Wellness Redefined on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, folks. Welcome to Inclusive Collective, where we share stories and learnings of inclusive people, organizations, and innovation. I am your co-host, Nadia Butt, an organizational development and belonging strategist. And I am joined by the lovely Rob Hadley, your other co-host, a people and culture strategist specializing in DE&I and people analytics. Rob, how are you this week?
I am lovely. Thanks, Nadia. Yeah. Great to be here. How you doing? Yeah.
You know, I'm April showers, bring May flowers, right?
I've never heard that. What is that something you just made up off the top of your head? What is that new?
Well, guess what, Rob? Do you know what else May brings?
What?
AAPI Heritage Month.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I actually wanted to do a little bit about that. Do you mind if I just share some things?
I will cede the floor. Yeah, go for it.
So Asian American Pacific Islanders Heritage Month consists of 30 plus countries and, of course, different ethnic groups who speak hundreds of different languages. This month first became a yearly observance after legislation was introduced in 1992, and it was designed to commemorate the arrival of the first known Japanese immigrant to the U.S. In 1843. And Rob, you know, just of course, you know this. I just want to share with our listeners that this community, it's so large, right? Like, especially in the U.S., when we think of Asian Americans, there's, of course, like East Asian, South Asian, Southeast Asian, right? Like, it's so broad. Asia is a huge continent. And of course, this group of people have experienced racial stereotypes, prejudice. And of course, more recently, this community was the target on anti-Asian hatred and crime during the pandemic. So I have just noticed and observed, it's been really wonderful to see the support and solidarity with the Asian community, not just like in this month, but also throughout the year. So I just wanted to share that with our listeners.
Yeah. So it's not just Asians. Is that what you're saying?
What do you mean?
No, in terms of, oftentimes, with regard to DEI initiatives or any kind of demographic data, all Asians are grouped together, and so each group or subset or of people of Asian descent, you can if you dig into the issues that they face in terms of either discrimination or how they're impacted by DEI in the workplace, it can be very different from group to group. So very glad you brought this up. And we'll come back to that over the course of our episodes within May. I think we should touch on it a couple more times.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for letting me talk through that.
Yeah. So let's talk about the details, or I'm sorry, we call it the deets, right? Is that what we do?
Yeah, let's get to the deets.
So Nadia, all right. So our first story this week, former advisor to the president, Stephen Miller. And yes, the hair on the back of my neck did stand up as I said that. And then it vomited. As I mentioned that name, apparently this gentleman has a new nonprofit and mission. So Miller's America First Legal filed a lawsuit last week against Mars, again, candy company, not the planet, for allegedly engaging in discriminatory hiring and promotion practices. The organization is using the fact that Mars has diversity goals and its commitment to DEI as an indication that it practices or has deeply unlawful and discriminatory practices. That's their reasoning. The fact that they have DEI is proof of that. So first of all, you know, welcome back, Stephen Miller. We missed you. It's just such a nice reminder of how nice the last 3 years have been without some of these so folks quiet. Running around. So any thoughts on this one before?
Just so that our audience understands, like, they're claiming like reverse racism, reverse sexism. Does that sound accurate in some ways? Okay. Yeah. Yes. I mean, so to me, it sounds like Mars is engaging in efforts where, like, they provide opportunities and access to resources that help make historically marginalized people equal to more dominant groups. And I don't see anything wrong with that. So
No. So it's ridiculous, right? And I'm guessing that Mars has very capable legal HR teams. They know what they're doing in terms of diversity target setting, right? From that standpoint, I'm sure it's all very rock solid with the way that they do it. Yep. And I feel like this claim will be dismissed. You know, they're looking for a judge that will actually give this some merit. But, you know, I did jot down like 5 best practices on setting DEI and specifically diverse representation targets. Do you want to hear them? I got 5 of them.
I want to hear them.
Okay. All right. 1, focus on process measures. So instead of representation goals, set goals to make sure that no one is either over or underrepresented in the hiring promotion in terms of retention in your company. 2, use gender and race neutral language. So we want to create opportunities for everyone. We're looking for parity, things of that nature. 3, set goals around improvement. So we want to be more representative as opposed to we want to have exactly X percent of a certain race. I think that's what Mars actually did do in this case. 4, when sharing your representation metrics for a people process, compare races to all other employees. So don't pit 2 races against each other in the way that they either set goals or report. So if it's Black Americans versus all other, right? Not Black versus white. And then set goals that can be achieved over time. So over a long period of time. So no one can say that, well, I felt pressure to meet a goal, so I made a decision based on race or gender. Right. Remember, Nadia, our goal is to make our lawyers nervous, but not angry.
That's hilarious. Totally. All right. Well, there's that. Anything else you want to add to that piece?
No. What's next?
So last week, I just flew this airline. So this is interesting. Alaska Airlines was forced to remove gendered uniforms due to a discrimination lawsuit filed by a non-binary and gender fluid flight attendant. So Alaska Airlines scrapped traditional male and female uniform requirements as part of ongoing legal battle involving the state of Washington. So this was the state of Washington and the employee. The Washington law permits all employees to dress and groom in a professional manner that is consistent with their gender identity and expression. So what happened was, a consent decree was issued after an agreement between Alaska Airlines and the Washington State AG's office, where Alaska Airlines has to pay the flight attendant $70,000 and the ACLU $40,000 for its legal fees. And then furthermore, Alaska will modify the uniform policy to remove the gendered restrictions and language on uniform pieces, facial, hair, jewelry, and makeup. Well, I'll pause there. What are your kind of reactions to that?
Well, we did something similar on this a few months ago, right? So Virgin Airlines, they basically say, here are a bunch of things to pick from. You do you, right? And I think that's really the right approach. And excuse me, Nadia, I'm starting to get a little annoyed by these stories, right? Yes. Like, aren't we about freedom here in the United States of America? Like, if I want to wear a dress, aren't I entitled to wear a dress, right? Like, seriously, right? This is the land of the free only if I wear pants, if I'm a man. Is that what we're talking about here?
Right.
And I think that this goes to all issues of workplace dress. So the dress code should always be dress appropriately for your role. And that should be it, right? That's pretty much it. So I am, very happy that our friend Justin, in this case, filed this lawsuit. And it seems like, and with help from the ACLU, and it seems like it's going to be impactful for a lot of people.
Yeah. So it's funny when you started saying, like, I'm annoyed. I'm also annoyed with what you said, but I'm also more annoyed. Like, there are legal implications and financial impacts that are very large for these organizations. Like, why are we not learning from prior past discrimination lawsuits? Like, it would be really wise if you're a business and an organization to follow suit to avoid other kind of legal disasters, right? Like, it's also just the right thing to do. Like, right. So for me, it's like, okay, Alaska Airlines, you've done this. So like the other American airlines that are out there, like follow suit, like do it now. I just don't understand why we take such a long time to like do the right thing. And we wait till
I'm looking at you, Delta right? Airlines, calling you out. Let's get a commitment from all the other airlines that this should be the policy. They should really have just learned from what Virgin did and just made that their policy and just moved on with life, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And save themselves a lot of money.
Absolutely. All right, well, that was more of a rant than it was a deep, but here we go. So that is it for the deep.
It was a little ranty.
Yeah. It was a little ranty, but you know what? The people are here for that, so... That is it for the deets. We will be right back with our guest, Alicia Thomas of Harvard Business School. Hi, folks. Welcome back. So this week on Inclusive Collective Podcast, we welcome Alicia Thomas, Director of Diversity and Inclusion, MBA and Doctoral Programs at Harvard Business School. Alicia has spent her entire career working in higher education and is passionate about supporting historically underserved communities in education. From academic advising to teaching, operations and budgets to admissions, orientation, programming development, and student club management, Alicia has served in roles that all center around the student experience, which I appreciate because I'm a student. In her current role, Alicia is able to use her experiences and training to support Harvard Business School students. She was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and received her bachelor's in economics from the University of Maryland, College Park, and her MBA with a focus in nonprofit management from the Smith School of Business at University of Maryland. Welcome, Alicia. Thank you for joining us this week on Inclusive Collective Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Alicia, welcome. It's so great to meet you. Thanks again for being with us. Can we start with some context for our listeners? So what does representation in the MBA and doctoral programs look like there at Harvard? So where are you with regard to gender, race? You know, MBA and PhD programs are very international. So how do you think about those students? Do you look at subsurface characteristics like socioeconomic background? Set the table for what these student bodies look like in 2023.
Yeah, absolutely. So for us, it's important to have the diversity of the nation kind of in our classes. So we have, like you said, a really heavy international population. We are at 38% international, which is, I think, about like average for most MBA programs kind of in our space. We are at almost parity for men and women. So we're at about 46% women, which is amazing, especially considering the boys club that is business world. So I'm always happy to hear about that 46% that continues to grow. And then in terms of our other demographics, we do look at race and gender. We look at, so for example, our Black and Black American, African American students are at around 13%. Mm-hmm. Who else? Let's see. Our Asian American students are at about 28%. White students, about 60%. Native Hawaiian, other Pacific Islander, we are at, let's see, pretty low percentage on that one, about 1%. Mm-hmm. So we really do look at the full spectrum and we try to get a good idea of who the students are when they come to us. But to your point, Rob, about like socioeconomic status and things like that, we are very intentional in asking questions like, help us understand your familial obligations, help us understand where your money is going, how much debt that you have right now, help us understand everything that goes into your regular lifestyle so that we can kind of be better prepared to serve you and to help you thrive once you get here. One thing that I love about our population is that we have a really strong partner population. So we are a residential campus and we have folks on campus. And so we have the daycare and we have the family centers. And so you will see the kids like walking around campus in their strollers and everything. So it's important to us that folks who really like come here, get the education they want, still feel supported, still make sure that their spouses feel seen and supported, and that they can still get their education and thrive.
That's great. I do love that there's a focus on the various dimensions of diversity. You know, of course, taking into consideration like the race, the gender, you said socioeconomic, of course, all the other factors and dimensions. I would imagine, though, there's probably still gaps. That's probably why you're on board and why there's still efforts. What are the efforts that you folks are starting to take as it relates to recruiting maybe historically marginalized students?
Yeah. So one of the reasons I even joined HBS in the Harvard community was this focus on the racial equity plan. So HBS has a racial equity plan that, similar to other programs, came out after George Floyd. But what it did is it specifically focused on supporting Black communities. Mm-hmm. And for me, if Harvard Business School can recognize that Black communities are deeply impacted and say that this is what we're putting towards it, mm-hmm. I'm on board, right? And so that, on top of having our Chief Diversity Officer, Gerald Drake, and he has a team. So there's been a ton of effort, money, and people put into the place to make sure that we can better support folks when they get to campus. And like, again, that was one of the main reasons I was like, okay, I feel more comfortable stepping into this role because it's not just me, which is what we see typically in this space. It's just one person with limited resources trying to like push the train to get it done. And at HBS, they were like, we have a team that's growing, we have a budget, and we have people. So please come and help us. So I would say one thing is the infrastructure. HBS has set up an infrastructure that can support us really getting some work done. From the representation perspective, we have admission staff that are dedicated to diversity outreach. And one thing that some of us are working on, including me right now, are figuring out, how do we stay more connected with HBCUs? How mm-hmm. do we make sure that we're bringing more people to campus so that they have exposure to HBS? Because in my opinion, you can't even like imagine yourself there until you are actually on the grounds with the rabbits and the like, all the beautiful animals
the
around. It's like this oasis, and it's amazing. But it's hard to stick, even imagine yourself there. Right? I couldn't imagine myself there until I actually went to visit. So one thing that's really important to me is bringing more people to campus to get exposure. And so one thing I did is I brought a group of students from Georgetown McDonough School of Business. So I used mm-hmm. to work there. I had a connection there, of course. But I was like, okay, how can we tap into these underserved populations? And so we were able to work with a group called Gamble at Georgetown. And this is diverse students, Asian American, Black, Latino, Native American, Pacific Islander, all of the above, basically. Mm-hmm. They came for a day. They got to sit in a class with our students. So they got to see it in action. They got to see the faculty in action. And that, to me, is like maybe the biggest way that we can make sure we're getting more representation in our numbers is making sure that we're exposing more and more people to HBS. Like, it is not this little pocket that only certain people can get access to. I want to make sure that it is a pocket that everyone can get access to and feel like they can be there and thrive and mm-hmm. do great things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I loved about 10 different things you said there. You know, let's go through each one of them. No, I think, but, you know, so the first thing was about the support that you have, right? And the fact that I think that only about 9% of DEI leaders have staff and dedicated budget, right? So it's usually a one person band trying to do these very complex initiatives as well. And then you talked about all the different programs you have. I just wondered, for all the different things that you're doing, all the activities, how much do you think about measuring the impact or the effectiveness, and just in a very broad sense, what do you think about measurement and what are some of the things that you're tuned into?
Yeah. So from the measurement perspective, I would say I try to get a ton of feedback. For me, it's checking in with everyone that has like crossed my path and literally mm-hmm. just asking the question of how it went. Because I feel like we get so caught up in like sending these reviews later or the rubrics later, and no one actually responds to them. So I'm like, how can I make sure that I'm getting it and like getting the good stuff before they leave? So I kind of make it a point to ask the questions, especially like after the DEI trainings that we put in place. I want to make sure that students are feeling like, okay, as soon as I leave the door of this DEI training, how am I feeling? What am I tapping into? What is going to be that next step for me? So data is incredibly important in this process. And so part of it for me is just having those one-on-one check-ins, taking notes of all of that, hosting focus groups just to make sure we're tapped into how students are actually feeling.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate hearing that because, you know,
and how feel sad like it makes me. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah. I want numbers. No. I think it's brilliant, actually. Yeah. Go ahead.
Now. Yeah. It is, right? Like getting that, because I'm a student as well, as both of you know. And I yearned like community. And when I was on campus, specifically for the doctoral program that I was in, and I was not alone, but it was also just a need that I needed. And I feel like if somebody had that really kind of cared, had asked what I was yearning, there probably could have been solutions that were provided to me. Anyways, that leads to my next question around like, you know, of course you're talking to students. I love that you're having interactions. It's not just like, here, take this survey, tell me through like a computer how you feel. You're actually speaking to them in person. Mm-hmm. What are you finding are kind of those now needs and accommodations of these students who I would imagine are all very different generations? And also now we're like in a world where it's, I don't want to say post-pandemic because we're not real. Well, I guess Biden said we're over, but like we've moved, you know, we did experience kind of 3 years of changing the way that we interact and connect in the classroom. So what are some of those needs and accommodations of students that you're finding that you're now having to put in either newer programs, you know, from that DE&I lens as it relates to students?
So what I think is interesting and like very different from I think when we went to school is that students are asking a lot more of the institution than they have in the past. And I think like being at when I was in school, I was just like, let me just get this done. I'm going to move forward. This isn't great, but no one's going to listen. And it's just going to take up time. Let me just move forward. Now, students are like, this is an issue and I really need someone to address this because if you're not addressing it for me, then someone else may be more deeply impacted. And part of me is like, okay, great. Our students are like thinking more broadly and they're thinking like, how can we make sure the world is better for the future? But also there are things, I mean, like little things that students will ask for now where I'm like, I just need you to use Google. Like, I don't know.
Right. Like Google. Yeah.
Right. So there is a balance. But I think that the biggest thing that students are looking for now is mental health support. That is a huge piece. And what is special about HBS is that we provide mental health support for our students that is housed in our offices and not in the larger Harvard community. So like the larger Harvard community has its own mental services, but we saw a need for our students to get this specialized support. And so what, from a DEI perspective, our African-American Student Union, for example, is looking for Black therapists to make sure that they're feeling supported. Our Latin American Student Association are looking for Latin American student therapists to make sure that they're supported. So mental health, I think, is the biggest piece that our students are asking for. They're looking for that support because the transition to come into business school is so intense. And we really it is truly drinking from the fire hose in any and every possible way. And our students are like, great, we'll lean into this. But also, are you going to make sure that I don't have a breakdown while we're going through this process? And I'm like, fair. I don't want you to have a breakdown. Like, let's make sure that you feel more supported. So we've done more programming around wellness, journaling. We're working on getting more therapists because in the world, it's just harder to find therapists of color, therapists in general. So those are just like some things on the mental health side that we're doing. Our clubs are so imperative to the HBS process that they provide support through tutoring. So we have tutoring and you can see the person who is the tutor. So if you feel more comfortable getting a tutor that is someone that looks like you, you can tap into that.
That's great.
Yeah, that's amazing. It is such a pressure cooker of an environment, mm-hmm. right? When you first step onto the campus there and into any kind of MBA program. So I was thinking about how you create the, I was thinking broadly about the environment. You said there's 60% white students. I'm sure there's a few white male students still hanging around at the Harvard Business School. I was thinking about how you create the right environment for DEI. What are the inclusive characteristics you look for from the white cis male students as you're either bringing them in, or how do you, what's the kind of programming for them so that, because, and I also think about Harvard as the outsized impact it has on creating leaders that will be at the top of organizational charts someday, and you want them to be inclusive leaders. So talk a little about how you think about those things.
Sure. I mean, that is our goal, is to train the future leaders of the world. And from my perspective, just like you, Rob, it's like these leaders have to be more aware, more cognizant of others and of difference and how that deeply impacts how they show up in this world and in this space. So there's a couple things. At HBS, we have a course that's called Inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so that is a required course for all of our students. And it is one of the first classes that they take. It really helps them think about how do you bring somebody in from a different perspective? How do you understand where they're coming from? And then how do you move forward and make sure that you're pushing forward and supporting them in the business mm-hmm. world? So we have that structure set into our curriculum, which is amazing. The other thing that we started is DEI trainings for all of our club leaders. Mm. So we're like slowly ingraining like more DEI support into the like different levels that our students interact. And so if we can get our student leaders to have the training, understand what it means to be an ally, understand the different isms that happen in the world, and understand how they are likely very much connected, understanding intersectionality and how they show up. Those are the pieces where we're like, okay, let's tap into our leaders, let's tap into our student government and have them start getting the training. And then we'll slowly start making sure that more and more of our students are able to get it. So we started DEI training when I got here in, let's say, we just did the DEI training last month. So really excited to have that. We also did, and I led like trainings on facilitating tough conversations, because I think that's a huge part of this too, is how do we even engage when we don't agree in the classroom? Sure. And folks get really stuck in that. And there is this idea of cancel culture. And I'm just like, this can't exist in this space if we're trying to like help each other grow. So we really focus on, okay, how do we make sure we understand how to talk to each other and how to bring each other in and tell each other, I don't agree, help me understand more from your perspective. Right. So those are the like trainings and programs that we put in place. Again, I haven't even been there for a year, so I'm excited to see what we can continue to offer and continue to like grow out this piece so that our, you know, students from the GOP club still feel supported and seen and still feel like they still have a place here.
Sure. You've spent time at different institutions. I'm curious, like, are there similarities? I'm sure students are similar from one institution to the next, but what are you finding in your short time at Harvard maybe versus where you previously worked or even attended or just heard? I'm just curious because we look at HBS as this really remarkable institution. I'm based in Boston, so it's an institution where people really kind of admire and look up to, and so I'm just curious, like, have you seen some of the differences just all around?
Yeah. So let me say this. HBS was never on my radar. Like in life, it was never like, oh, yes, I will have a step on HBS's campus. Never crossed my mind. In my MBA program, we also did, like every other business school, we used their cases in class. So that's how I was aware of HBS. And you know, like this Harvard, the great Harvard, right? And I would say, so I worked at Georgetown McDonough School of Business before this. And that was like the best preparation for me to step into Harvard. Before Georgetown, I was at University of Maryland. So that is a state school where like resources are low. We can give pizza parties. And that's like, that's as far as you can go, right? And so then I got to Georgetown and I was like, okay, now we're at a private school. We got a little bit more money that we can work with, a little bit more resources. But we're also dealing with a very different population of student who is typically privileged, typically has more access, typically more connected, and had very different lived experiences than some of our state school students. Because Georgetown prepared me so well for the Harvard Business School because it was still the type A, really strong personalities, a lot of privilege coming to the table, but also high expectations of the institution. So then when I got to Harvard, first I had to come to terms with I'm at Harvard, which is like a whole other, right? A whole other thing. And once I got to the point where it's like, okay, these are all normal people who are just trying to make the world a better place, like I am. Awesome. Mm-hmm. You look at our students, and our students are also typically privileged, typically have access, but we do have this really great pool of students who are just maybe didn't have access, maybe didn't come from, you know, the best part of Massachusetts or the best part of the world, and they're still able to thrive here. So we have a really strong first-gen low-income club. Mm-hmm. And that really like encompasses a lot of our students who just come from these different backgrounds. And that's like how we make sure that we're supporting them as they're in this bucket. So I think access to resources was the biggest like amazing moment for me. I was like, oh my gosh, one, you all are giving me a budget.
Right.
That's amazing. Two, I can use it as I see fit. And three, there are additional resources, and then there's alumni that I can tap into. So it's like the access,
right?
Once you get to HBS, it's like, it's the same thing that the students come for, is this access and network. That's the same thing I'm getting. And so it's been great because I've had alum check in with me and they're like, let's make this program happen. So I'm like, great, let's figure out how to make it happen. And these are, you know, folks who are really successful and doing amazing things in the world. So we can make it happen. They can, right. Like, that is the thing for me. Like, we can actually make this stuff happen and set the tone and set the stage for the rest of the institutions in this nation.
Yeah. You almost have the opportunity to create that standard, right?
It's all there. And then HBS and Harvard are intentional. If not anything else, they are intentional with everything that they do. So they set up the stage for the DEI folks to be able to make an impact. And you don't see that everywhere.
Yeah, I love that. And it's almost like resources are unlimited, right? Like it's you can do pretty much everything you want. And it also puts some pressure on the institution and then you as the leader of DEI there to really set the pace for the rest of the programs in the country, right? So, yeah. And I do have one of my best friends did go to that Smith School of Business as well there at Maryland. So I'll have to ask him about the pizza parties there as well. So, but that's one hell of a business school too, by the way.
It is. And, great program.
Yeah. So, Alicia Thomas, again, thanks so much for being with us. As we just wrap up here, just wanted to see, can you give our listeners, you know, one resource that you recommend, something that you're into right now related to DEI that you think would be helpful?
Sure. So this is going to maybe sound a little cheesy, but I'm going to throw out Harvard Business Review as a resource. So if you go to our oh,
we love it.
We love it. We love it. I mean, I read one at least once a day. Yes. So, yeah.
So I can go, literally, you can go in and type in diversity into the Harvard Business Review and see a ton of articles and research being done by folks, not just on this campus, but outside of campus. And so for me, that's like a great place where you can see what business leaders are suggesting is a good practice in the DEI space. Now, is it all encompassing? No. Is it like probably as deep of knowledge? Maybe not. But I think the business application is what's super helpful because that's what makes it tangible and like seem realistic and you can make this happen. And that's what I appreciate the most.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great.
Rob is walking out like, no.
I know. Rob's like, I'm out.
You know, I'm a subscriber.
He's a subscriber. Look at him.
I have a print subscription. I'm reluctant to acknowledge. But yes, no, it's all very curated too. So it's like, it is the best of the best in thinking around DEI a lot of times. So I fully support that recommendation.
Yeah,
me too.
That's where I lean towards, because even when our staff are looking for support, I'm like, let's just start here where we know it applies to business and we know that it can likely be applicable to the issue at hand. And then we can like continue to take steps back to say, okay, is there a deeper issue that we need to talk about? Like, okay, do we need to bring in a facilitator to engage with us? Like, we just keep kind of taking those steps back, but it's a great place to start.
For sure.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Alicia Thomas, thank you so much for joining us on Inclusive Collective, especially because there's graduation coming up and commencement, and I know you're super busy, but we appreciate you coming and joining us and sharing such great insight of the good work that's happening at Harvard Business School.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back with our Conreflections and Raves and Rants. Welcome back, folks. We just finished chatting with Alicia Thomas, Director of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion of the MBA and Doctoral Program at Harvard Business School. Rob, I mean, I'm going to share my thoughts really briefly, and then I want to just ask you for yours.
Sure.
But I really appreciated the student focus, the student experience, right? Like, of course, I'm a lifelong learner. Lifelong student, I feel like, at this point. And I just appreciate the efforts that Alicia and her team are focused on in bringing a more inclusive and equitable campus, especially because Harvard Business School is this institution we all like know about. Mm-hmm. I don't want to generalize and say everybody admires, but we absolutely all know about. And it is almost like the epitome of where people think, I don't know. It's an institution that people look at. And so, and I also really appreciate her talking about mental health awareness and support that's needed for the students, because it is Mental Health Awareness Month as well. And so I appreciate her bringing that to attention for students, because studying and learning is tough right now on college campuses.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's the second best business school in the world, right? Next to Wharton, right?
I got that.
Yeah, you got that one. No, I think so. From a very personal perspective, right? I thought about mental health too. It made me think, with all the resources they have, I wish I could go to business school now. That wouldn't make much sense because I'm 47 years old now. But I was just really excited about that aspect. I was in that pressure cooker, right? And the amount of anxiety for people, from different backgrounds that go into that group, and where it's like, it's the elite of the elite. Everyone's, 1,000 times smarter than you. And everyone's, really type A and all trying to change the world. And it's like, it's a lot. It's a lot to take on, right? And so those were not resources that I had access to when I was a student, 15 years ago. And so it just made me think, I was really proud of the evolution of that, and the destigmatization of seeking out mental health resources when you're a student in these elite business schools. And then I also really appreciated that first-gen low-income club as well. That's something that I think that when I was there, that it would have been, super helpful, right? In terms of being able to look around and say, because again, it is people of privilege, of extreme privilege. And so just having others to be able to say, hey, this is new for people from my background would have been, and I can imagine that's very, very helpful for those students as well. So I loved it. And it sounds like they're doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of leading the way. And that's what we look to the Harvard Business School for, right? And so it seems like they're doing a great job. And I'm excited to see that Alicia is leading the way for them as well.
Yeah, just so our listeners know, of course, we had Alicia on to talk about the student experience, but in a few weeks, we're going to have some professors who are focused on the teaching aspect and the professor experience. And so that'll be interesting. So you want to definitely take a listen on that episode as well.
Yeah.
Did we do the coin toss?
We did the coin toss. And I believe you are ranting. You're ranting.
Yeah.
You got a rant for us.
Mm-hmm, I have a good one too. So this is, yeah. So my local library, my local public library here, is hosting an event. It's an online event called Dishing Out Drag with Giganta Smalls.
Okay.
Where they're inviting teens between the ages of 13 and 18 to learn what the life of a drag performer is like and get tips on getting started in the world of drag. And Rob, I can't even tell you how many trolls are trolling and how many negative comments there are entering this space. Mm-hmm. And I am ranting because social media is just not good sometimes. And how cool it is for my local library to offer this to youngins. And just like trolls just gotta stop trolling. Like, they gotta get a life. That's all I gotta say.
I like how you said social media is like sometimes bad. It's mostly bad.
Other than the pictures of my baby.
Are you going to attend this? I feel like you should attend this to support.
It's free. So I reshared it and I loved like all the positive comments, but it's for teens ages 13 to 18. So I might, if I live registered, it might look creepy.
Yeah.
But I actually, my sister gave me the advice of actually reaching out to my local library and emailing them and just saying like, what a great program this is, like, can you know, and if I can support in any way, because I believe there are like our endowments and things like that local libraries tend to, or contributions that local libraries will accept. So I will definitely be reaching out to them. But you know, I'm sure there's other local libraries and other towns across America where programs like this are happening. And I just want to, you know, encourage people that if you support these types of programs, then like let the local libraries and library trustees know, because they're important learning opportunities for our young growing minds.
Awesome. I love that. Thanks for that, Nadia. All right. So let's rave. Nadia, we opened season 2, I believe, with me saying something to the effect of the monarchy was the biggest symbol of white supremacy for many people in the world. I said something to that effect. So it got me in a little bit of a tiff with the royal family. And so now today.
Did you get a call or something?
Yeah. It was a big social media battle between me and the royals. But I think, you know, but I'm here today to say we have to take it all back, right? So we're talking about the coronation. And so this, for the coronation of King Charles, there will be several nods to inclusivity. Royal Navy Petty Officer Amy Taylor will be the first woman to carry the jeweled sword of offering to Westminster Abbey. Also, for the first time, non-Christian religions will participate, with other faiths taking part in the entry procession. Lord Indarjit Singh of Wimbledon, editor of the Sikh Messenger magazine, will present the king with the coronation glove. And Baroness Gillian Maron, chief executive of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, will carry one of the king's royal robe. Nadia, there you go. All is forgiven. I take it all back.
Progress.
Yes. Long live the king. I stand corrected.
Well, I mean, I think that this is progress towards improvement. And there's probably still some gaps, but I will give you the rave because I don't want to be the negative Nelly today.
Yes. All is forgiven. We're all on the same team now.
Yeah.
Me and the British royal family. So.
Oh.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Okay. That's all it took. That's great. Okay. Well, folks, the Inclusive Collective is a production of Rafilian Media. We thank Alicia Thomas for joining us this week. We'd love to hear from you folks, so send us your feedback at inclusivecollective@rafilian.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. If you like what you heard, please be sure to subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us for consulting, check me out at nasconsultants.com and Rob at taconoconsulting.com. Folks, don't forget, Rob is hosting a DE&I Metrics Measurement and Reporting Masterclass on May 11th. Sign up at climateforDEI.com, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks, Nadia.
Be well.